Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of the Mushroom Revival Podcast. We are unbelievably obsessed with healing power of mushrooms. We are so excited to bridge the gap between you, our beautiful, inspiring listeners, and the wonderful, wacky, interesting world of fungi and mushrooms. We bring on guests and experts from all around the world to geek out with us, to go on a journey into that world of mushrooms. So strap in, tune in, and shroom in to another episode.
Today's mycological highlight is on Beatrix Potter, a renowned author and lesser-known mycologist from the 19th century. And we are welcoming Dale DeBaxi, who has extensive knowledge on Beatrix and her mycophilia. Welcome, Dale.
Hooray, thanks for having me.
So before we get super nerdy with Beatrix, can you share a bit more about yourself?
So for a while now, I've been writing the Women in Science column at Women You Should Know. So every other week, there's a new figure. We've been doing this since 2013. Beatrix Potter is one that had always been something I had always been meaning to do, but had always found ways to distract myself away from. Until one day, by chance, I was in a bookstore and a charming volume called Over the Hills and Far Away, which is a biography of Beatrix Potter, was just sitting there looking at me, somewhat accusatorily, I think, but saying, Dale, why haven't you done me yet? And so I picked it up, and it was just charming, and the work was that she had did was so surprisingly, beyond that you would expect, because of course the 19th century featured a number of amateur mushroom enthusiasts, naturalist enthusiasts. It was the sort of high watermark for sort of amateur science. And I was just so taken back by the scale of what she was able to do, given her background, her life, that the time was up, and it was time to get down and finally cover her. And plus, I've been looking for a long time to have an excuse to do a mycologist, because they're always just really interesting. I've covered a few on the Women in Science column now. And they always just have just neat life stories, it turns out. There's just something that drives you to that study, which just produces interesting life stories. So that was that. Spent some time going into her backstory. There's a lot of great stuff about her and her work that made it a lot easier than a lot of the stories that I have to do on Women in Science, where they didn't write about themselves at all, and other people didn't write about them either, and you just have to look in the shadows for them. Beatrix Potter is not as much in the shadows, thanks, of course, to her books. So that made it easier.
And unfortunately, she couldn't make it on the show today. She has since left her body for quite a while. But she is an unbelievable badass, and I'm really, really excited to highlight her. And thanks for coming on the show to honor her and tell the world about her history, her work, and kind of highlight why she is such a badass for not only the mycology community, but she's an incredible author as well, and naturalist and human being. So mm-hmm. I'm excited to get into it.
And the last thing you said, it was something I wanted to ask you, was how exactly you conduct research on like dead people, and especially people who, I mean, luckily Beatrix seemed to have kept a diary and was documenting her life. But could you talk a bit about how you went about this research, where you looked, and kind of the more obscure paths and archives that you had to unearth?
Yeah, well, I mean, luckily, it is Beatrix Potter, who is, one of the world's most beloved figures ever. She is somebody whose the flow of her words is in the DNA of every person who had a childhood to speak of. Right. So being able to do somebody who is so beloved and is much, much more well-documented, like I said, than most of the figures I have to do. Most of the figures that I have, I have to deal with scraps and just little pieces of information here and there, and stitch them together as best I can, in between, you know, my regular job of teaching high school, which has its own time demands, we'll say. But Potter, you get a few good things. One is, of course, that she is so universally beloved and was since 1901 when Peter Rabbit first comes out, that people have never stopped being interested in her and writing about her. The other one, which is, of course, the huge help, is that she kept this diary. Granted, it was in code from 1881 to 1897. And, you know, it was written in code, which is the absolute bane of her biographers. But luckily, somebody went through and actually decoded it. And it's available. It's readily available in print. And we also have the wonderful work of Linda Lear, who wrote Beatrix Potter, A Life in Nature, which is sort of the authoritative account of Potter's life and her world, in addition to that, and the world of sort of 19th century amateur naturalism. So all of those things together made my work a heck of a lot easier than it usually is for other figures that I've had to do, like Cardi Raper, who I don't know if you've had a chance to talk with her and her work in mycology, a lot more difficult to flag down. Thankfully, she wrote a memoir. But yeah, Potter, there was a lot going for me. Like the figure that I'm doing right now, I am, you know, I would say it's 4 hours of research for every like 3 lines of actual end text that I end up getting to write. So yeah, lucky on this one.
So most people know Beatrix Potter for her work, Peter Rabbit, which a lot of kids read that book when they were a kid, or if they're your parents, you've read your kid that book. And it's a really, really well-known children's book and many other books as well that she wrote. And another aspect of her life, which is pretty major, is that she was an avid mycologist and an all-around naturalist and a beautiful painter and illustrator of the natural world, and spent a lot of her studies on spores and germination of mushrooms and fungi and lichen. How did she get fascinated into that world of mycology and mushrooms in the first place?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And it's something that ties into that world of 19th century science and the limitations on being a woman in the 19th century in England. What you were encouraged to do and what you were more or less rigidly prevented from doing. And for her, you know, she comes from a family. Her grandparents were wealthy through producing calico cloth. And so there was a decent amount of money in the family. Her parents didn't have to work. Her father loved photography and he loved art. And that's what he spent his time sort of devoted to. And he shared his enthusiasm for that with Beatrix. Beatrix didn't go to school. She had a series of governesses, which was, you know, common for her, you know, socioeconomic position at the time. And they sort of gave her an education in languages. One of the big helps to her being a mycologist later on was her knowledge of German, because the Germans were doing much more advanced work than the English at the time. So that helped her later studies immensely, but also lots and lots of training in art, which she was instantly revealed to have a particular ability for showing realism. Even in like Peter Rabbit or Jeremy Fisher, where you've, you know, you've got frogs in, you know, jackets, it's still like these incredibly beautiful, detailed renderings of the frogs and the plants around them. And that helped because the artistic school that was popular at that time was this pre-Raphaelite artistic movement, which focused really a lot on light and detail and just natural detail in all the background work. And her family was connected with some of the pre-Raphaelite artists and supported them. And so, and she went to their studios and saw how did they produce these incredibly detailed, beautiful works. So she had that just natural instinct and access to people to help her along with that. But more than that, she just was an absolute nature fiend from the start. So she had basically a private zoo in her room that she and her younger brother would just find critters out in nature and kind of sneak them into the house and then just have them living up in their room. So there were, you know, mice and rabbits and bats and, you know, newts and all this stuff just living around. And then, you know, she treated them beautifully and loved them. But then when they died, she boiled them to get down to their skeletal structure so she could draw the skeletal structure, too, and learn more about them. So she had this intense naturalist's eye from the start and desire to get into nature. And she also had the fact that there was nothing for her to do beyond the roles of, you know, a daughter of a family. She wasn't expected to ever have a job. She wasn't expected to go to school, to go to university. And that gives you a huge amount of time to fill, which, you know, as all of us in COVID time knows, spending all of your time inside with your family gets to be a bit much. So she would go out at every opportunity to flee the household, to go into nature. And she noticed more and more, especially as she, you know, heads into her late teens, the world of mushrooms is that they're just such strange objects out there, which she had been sort of primed to love because she also lived in the high watermark of fairy literature, right? So these were beautiful illustrated books filled with tales of fairies and mushrooms and, you know, and in this interrelated world. So every time that she saw a mushroom, even when she was a little bit older, it carried with it that sort of childhood enthusiasm for this mystical world. And I think that's what got her started painting them. She starts in about 1887 when she's 21. But she doesn't get real serious about it until 1892, when she meets a very interesting person who inspires her to go into it much more deeply.
Hey, guys.
If you love the show and want to continue getting tantalizing mushroom content such as this, please consider supporting us by going to mushroomrevival.com and purchasing one of our amazing mushroom products.
This is how we keep the lights on. This is a total passion project. We do not offer any outside advertisers, and this has totally revolutionized our health. We want to spread the mushrooms far and wide in every corner possible. If you're listening to this, we will offer you a special coupon code that we're not offering anybody else. If you're listening to this, this is a little Easter egg that you just found. The coupon code is called
PODTREAT, PODTREAT, all caps.
And to figure out how much you actually save, you got to figure it out. You got to open that Easter egg as well and put it into your cart to find out a special offering that only you will get. We love these products. They help revolutionize our health, and we want to share that health and abundance with you guys who equally love mushrooms as much as we do. So when you go watch a movie, you get a bowl of popcorn, obviously. So when you listen to mushroom podcasts, you get a mushroom tincture pumping through your veins, pumping through your eardrums. You are a mushroom. Help the Mushroom Revival. We love you guys so much. Back to the show.
One thing I'm so interested in about the more like intimate research that Beatrix was doing was how she was able to get so scientific, doing things like germinating spores and observing the symbiosis between algae and fungi and lichen. And I did some research, and the Petri plate wasn't even invented until a couple years before she really dived into this science. So I'm so curious about what tools she had and was able to implement in the late 1800s to observe these fungi. Can you speak to these intimate details?
Yeah. And you're right, is that, you know, her career with this kind of breaks into two parts. There's the part, well, I'll say three parts. I'm going to go back and forward on that number. But anyway, so there's the part where she's primarily just painting things more or less unsystematically, where she comes across something in one of her drives or in one of her sprawls throughout nature, and it's beautiful and interesting and different, and she decides she has to paint it because she has this instinct to just paint things that are different. And then in 1892, she doesn't meet, because she'd known him for a while. He was the postman of the potter's old summer house up in Dalgees, in Scotland. So he used to be this postmaster who walked, it's estimated, 200,000 miles over the course of his career. And that allowed him just rambling through, delivering post all over the Scottish countryside. And as he was doing that, it allowed him to see minutely the nature of Scotland, and he became known as one of the great amateur mycologists of the 19th century, an expert on Scottish mushrooms and fungi. And he just happened to be the postman for her little town that she would summer in. And in 1892, she got a chance to talk with him. As she's a little bit older, he had happened to move to a place where she had access to him, and they overcame the problem, which was he was from a different social class than her, right? Which meant that she couldn't just go to him, because that would have been unheard of for a daughter of a respectable household to visit even this incredibly esteemed mycologist, because he was an ex-postman, and that was unheard of. So there was very elaborate plan to get them to meet each other. And he started, he saw how enthusiastic but sort of unsystematic she was. And she really wanted to learn more at this point about the more detailed work of taxonomy, of mycological taxonomy, which he was an expert in, preparations, and of creating scientific illustrations. That would be useful for the scientific community, rather than just merely beautiful, but that also illustrated parts of the structure of mushrooms that would be useful. So he taught her that, and so this is 1892 that she's doing that, and then she starts getting curious about, like you were talking about, the germination of spores, and she's asking herself this question. You know, all great scientists just sort of ask themselves questions, things that they wonder about, is what happens to mushrooms over the winter? Right. What is the structure that allows them to come back over the winter? And she went to the Natural History Museum, and they were sort of about it. Because that wasn't the thing that the researchers were really interested in at the time in England. So she decides she's going to do it. She's going to make a study of it herself. And she's lucky because she is related to an eminent British naturalist, Sir Henry Roscoe. And he puts her in touch with a chemist named Joseph Lunt. And that chemist teaches her how to prepare sterile slides. Teaches her about the nutrient formulas that they use for different types of I don't want to say vegetable, but different types of, I guess, non-animal life. And so it's at that point where she's able to now, she's got these different nutrient sort of recipes from this eminent chemist She's able to prepare more sterile slides so that she can fend off questions about contamination, right? A lot of people were skeptical about her work because they say, you're just doing this in your kitchen, which was correct enough. You know, all these things that you're seeing, these germination effects that you're seeing, and later on her work with that algae and fungi have a symbiotic relationship in lichens, all that's just artifacts of contamination. And so Lunt helped her prepare those slides so she could document that. And then when she's getting ready to write this final paper, after basically the people at the queue, you know, the primary botanical powerhouse of the 19th century, the Kew Gardens, they were just, to be colorful about it, they were just raving dicks to her when she came to them with her ideas. And so Henry Roscoe took great exception to this. No relative of Henry Roscoe is going to be treated this way. We're going to sit down. We're going to create a, you know, absolutely rigorous, you know, balls to the wall rigor paper about your findings, and I'm going to get it presented at the Linnaean Society, and people are going to know that you're doing legitimate work. And at that time, she gets access to some petri dishes as well. If you look at some of her later drawings, they have petri dishes. So she did evolve over time her techniques. But yeah, at first it was very, you know, I found this thing, I'm going to pick it and bring it into my kitchen and hope that I can draw it before it shrivels too much. Later on, it is petri dishes, sterile slides, all the stuff that 19th century science could reasonably expect you to do.
And one of those, you know, developments was the theory of fungal hybridization, which I read on Wikipedia. I don't know how that's not so much of a credible source, but you know, I did some very basic research on even plant hybridization, and it really wasn't even around for that long, and only two researchers were really theorizing it, practicing plant hybridization. And so the idea of even hybridization really in practice was very, very new. So for her to put out that theory of fungal hybridization is huge. Although, you know, many different levels of hybridization, but yeah, it goes beyond just painting. It's really fascinating how she can have these dual worlds of being one of the world's best authors and also, you know, an incredible mycologist that is doing, you know, leading edge research that is pushing this industry forward.
You know, it's such it was a very courageous thing for her to take up, you know, the theories about fungal hybridization and the ideas of, you know, fungus algae hybrids and symbiotic hybrids. At the time, because this was basically to invite ridicule for her to come out and talk about these things and to talk about, because, you know, most people, when they heard symbiosis and hybridization, they thought of this Swedish mycologist from 1867, 1869, depending on where you look, who proposed dual organism theories. And those theories were picked up in Germany. So if you look at like Heinrich Anton de Berry, Albert Frank, Melchior Troib, some of those figures in mid-19th century German writings, they picked up on this and said, yeah, this seems valid. But England, by and large, mocked these ideas that to be labeled a Schwendenerist. Schwendener was the Swede who came up with these ideas, was basically to be labeled a crank. You know, she walked into the queue, and like I say, walking into Kew Gardens, it is the authority in Britain at the time for anything pertaining to botanical matters. And she walks in and sees that, you know, she says, look, I've done these things. I've done these germinations. I've looked at the lichen. I've done some experiments to show, you know, how the chlorophyll component contributes to the fungal component. And she's basically just treated as, that's nice. Leave us alone, by and large. We don't have the letter when she presented her findings to the director of the queue, but apparently it was so rude that her uncle, Henry Roscoe, just refused to let her see it. He was like, it is so insulting that I'm not going to let you see it, but we're going to get together. We're going to work your ideas into this paper. It's not that her ideas were totally new. I think if they were totally new, that would have been one level of courage. The second level of courage is to know that ideas are hated, to know that your experiments show that those ideas are still good and need to be taken seriously, and then to fight for those ideas as, you know, a single woman amateur naturalist in the face of the most powerful men in English botany. That was something else. And to have that level of self-confidence to carry on that fight. And she's so blasé about it. Like in her writings, in her diaries, she's just like, oh, you know, I went over there, you know, to the most powerful men in botany, and, you know, I told them how it was. And you know, they were rude about it. But she doesn't, you know, it's just so much confidence. And then to bounce back and present a paper to the Linnaean Society about the thing that you have just been so dismissed about at the queue, it's a remarkable display of just inner fortitude from Beatrix Potter. And you wouldn't think it, you know, reading Jeremy Fisher or, you know, or Jemima Puddle Duck, that the person who's writing these very soft, you know, beautiful little stories was able to stand up to the most powerful organizations in 19th century British naturalism. It's pretty incredible.
Yeah, I think that just augments her badassness, because it's one thing to have done that, but then to have done it in her era, where misogyny was very real. And I'm pleased that she was able to get her work read at the Linnaean Society, although she wasn't allowed to read it herself or even attend the meeting, which is just so silly. But is there anything else you can speak to for what she has to say about women in science and insights you had to that whole reality?
Yeah, I mean, so much. This is probably have to reel me back. This is sort of the consuming interest of my life is talking about the evolution of women's place in scientific research. Now it's the last 8 years of my life I've been devoted to this. So I will probably have too much to say, but I will try and hit the highlights, which is or the lowlights, as the case may be. Is that basically, it's interesting when you have women in science and what they're allowed to study at any given time is really socially coded in strange ways. So for instance, in America, right, we have astronomy is a big thing, because here letting women study biology in the 19th century was considered dangerous, because if you study biology, then you might study Darwin. And if you study Darwin, then you might start doubting religion. And if you start doubting religion, you might start doubting the structure of marriage and the structures of life as you've had them presented to you. So we're going to steer you away from life sciences. We're going to steer you toward astronomy, which basically at that time was just sort of looking at the night sky and making images of what you see. Or we're going to steer you towards mathematics, which is even more abstract and safe. It doesn't have any like social realizations that you might make. So here, you know, we have a lot of, you know, there's this astronomical kind of powerhouse that comes out in American, the history of women in science. In Britain and France, you have these positive manias, amateur manias for naturalism. So you would have, for example, some of the most popular selling books at the time were books about family microscope experiments, where basically, you know, the family would all go out and they'd look for stuff and they'd bring it back and you'd look at it under the microscope and you'd look on this book and you'd argue amongst yourselves about, oh, which species is this? What is it? Can you see this structure? Can't you? Which sounds unspeakably charming, like as a family pursuit that we're going to have an evening dedicated to, you know, microscopy and to just amateur naturalism is something incredible. But women were very much part of that world. It was considered to be sort of a good compromise. It got you out in the air. It got you a little bit of exercise, which was starting to be recognized as an important thing. That, you know, a lot of the problems that that women were having health wise was a result of being almost immobile for huge stretches of their existence. This idea of being too weak to be allowed to take up any kind of vigorous physical activity just kind of produced this vicious cycle of immobility creates health problems, which creates more immobility, which creates more health problems. That was starting to, people were starting to see around that in the late 19th century and to see the virtue of allowing, you know, your daughters to go out into nature and, you know, collect stuff and paint stuff. It was considered to be this sort of intersection of artistic insight with sort of an appreciation of the natural order, which many people thought would bring people closer to God rather than further away. So it was deemed to be sort of safe in that regard, as long as you did it sort of in a gentlewomanly way. There were figures like Margaret Fontaine, who became this international, really interesting figure. She was an entomologist who became known for traveling the entire world over in search for rare insects. And just, you know, writing these travelogues of her very intense experiences in parts of the world that have never been explored before by, you know, British tourists and French tourists looking for remarkable insects. That was a bit too much for a lot of people. But the idea of going into the countryside and doing this, that was accepted. Where it ran up against problems was when you tried to gain access to the established community. And there's always this turnover that when a field gets professionalized, when it gets to the point that you can make money doing it, that's when the women tend to get shoved out of the profession. So the first, like I said before, the first American astronomer was a woman. As soon as she started being able to make money for her astronomical surveys, then her positions at universities and the number of women students that she had just dropped dramatically because men saw, oh, we can make money at this. Elbow! And they just rush in. And same thing with ecology. Ecology was founded here by Ellen Swallow, who did most of the foundational studies for the chemical analysis of air, water, sanitation in the home, heating in the home, sanitation in prisons, nutrition in prisons, like that we should actually study these things and know what's going into food and air and water and all this stuff. Those were done by her basically on her own. And then, of course, she starts making professions out of these things and gets shoved into a period of enforced silence, where she's basically not allowed to talk at all about her findings for a year while male professors start taking over the positions that she had before. And you see this in naturalism as well, that in the 19th century, there is this thriving world of amateur naturalists. So Beatrix Potter loves mycology. She also loves geology and she loves paleontology. These are kind of the three big natural influences of her life. And as long as she's painting them and making illustrations, people are fine. But it's once she starts claiming scientific knowledge that's different than the received scientific knowledge that she gets into trouble. And you see this over and over and over in the history of women in science. If you look at Cecilia Payne Gaposchkin, she was the one who said that stars are made up overwhelmingly of hydrogen. Her studies overwhelmingly showed that that happened. And when she brings it to officials, they're like, no, you are wrong. You're going to have to recant your findings. That confrontation with authority just does not go well, depending on what country you're in, well into the 20th century. And some would say it continues to be so. But there's a lot of issues going into it that you can go thus far and no farther is really the predominant theme. Even in medicine, again, I'm talking too much about this. I'm sorry. In medicine, like you had the amateur community, the sort of this very strong tradition of women doctors in towns, and that's a very strong tradition in like Germany into the 17th and 18th centuries, and then they're just cut out of the picture as soon as the medical profession professionalizes itself. Their first move is to make sure that women can't get licenses to do the stuff that they've been doing for centuries and centuries and centuries. So that's a long answer to what position she was in kind of the overall structure of women in science. She was very lucky to have important relatives in natural science. That's how she gets her Linnaean Society paper presented. But they basically present it, they put it on the table for people to look at, and then send it back to her. We don't actually have the paper today. That's how much it disappeared. It was great that she was able to do it, but basically this was a favor to Henry Roscoe, by and large, to Sir Henry Roscoe. And once they had fulfilled that, they ignored it, in spite of the fact that almost all of its findings, as we know, were validated later.
And I thought it was funny. I think, what was it, 5 years later that she, after that event, she wrote Peter Rabbit and became this, you know, world-renowned author. And I thought that was just, what funny timing to go through that experience of not being able to present and then, you know, writing one of the most world-famous books ever to kind of show them, you know, what she's capable of. And she's done these beautiful, like over 350 beautiful watercolors of fungi, mushrooms, spores, lichen, all these fungal depictions. Are there any cases of her weaving those characters in her books and kind of weaving in fungi in her narratives and her illustrations?
Oh, that's a good question. There are, you do see some kind of, you know, out in the corners of things. There's not like an entire fungus focused book, but her illustrations do get picked up in the 20th century as these sort of authoritative illustrations that a century later they get picked up and used in actual scientific texts. I think 67 of her illustrations were used in a collection about British fungi. So her works are eventually used for science, and they're recognized for their accuracy and their detail. It's funny that it's actually really close that there was this fateful course of 3 days in 1893, where on September 3rd, she finds this ultra, ultra rare fungus, Strobilomyces strobilaceus fungus that had basically the first time it had ever been seen was 6 years before. And she is able to capture it and render it and produce kind of these first full detailed accounts of it. That's September 3rd. The next day, September 4th, she sits down to write to her, Noel Moore, this young child, and she writes him a picture letter, the day after she's discovered this rediscovered this incredibly rare fungus. And the start of it begins with, you know, the famous line, I don't know what to write to you, so I shall tell you a story about four little rabbits whose names were Flopsy, Mopsy, Cottontail, and Peter. And this, it's this full story that she's written for this kid just to make him happy. And it's basically the story of Peter Rabbit. And the day after that, she realizes that he just had a new baby brother. Who recently came into the world, and that he should have a storybook too. So she sits down and writes him a story of this little frog who decides he's going to go fishing. And that frog's name is Jeremy Fisher. So within 3 days, she's had this big mycological discovery, which she's documented for the first time, invents Peter Rabbit, and then the very next day invents Jeremy Fisher, just as sort of something casual, just like, oh, what? I'm just going to send this to these kids and to make them a little bit happier. And then, as you said, in 1901, that Peter Rabbit story becomes, a literary juggernaut that it inspires a huge industry of not only the books, but also merchandising. She's also kind of a pioneer in terms of literary merchandising, where you could get Peter Rabbit stuff. And she took the money that she got from that and used it to buy land that she thought was in danger of getting sort of, you know, run through by railroads, or like, you know, basically, you know, our current idea of, you know, paving over paradise and putting up a parking lot. Right. She was making sure that she took her money that she earned from these characters and used it to preserve as much of the old countryside as she could, the places where she had done her tromping. And she just was terribly worried that the nature that she enjoyed and that was so open to her and so open to her mind was in danger of being lost, that we were going to rush too quickly into the modern age and just tear up all of our natural legacy before we realized what we were doing. So she's also this sort of ecological, environmental pioneer as well. That's very rare for the 19th century for people to be thinking that far ahead of, like, what would happen if we kept doing this? Right. That's something you start picking up, like when you start getting super highways in the 1950s. But for somebody to be thinking that in 1897, when it's nowhere near that dangerous, that's something special. But that is what people liked about them, was not only these animals, but the worlds in which they live, that Sir Jeremy Fisher's pond has, you know, realistic botanical features in it, that Mr. McGregor's garden, same thing. All of the plant life there is rendered quite lovingly. You do get the odd mushroom here and there. I can't say off the top of my head, unfortunately, which books they're in if people want to rush to their home copies of Beatrix Potter to find them. But, you know, it's not a wasted night to just sit and read through them all until you find them, because they are just beautiful. So just do it. It doesn't matter that you're an adult. These are some of the most beautifully illustrated things ever. So even if you're not reading it for the words, which are a whole different topic, the art is worth it. This is the golden age of children's illustration. And she is one of the reigning titans of that. So spending time with her is never time wasted.
Yeah, her art is gorgeous. I was very impressed with the accuracy of these renderings. It'd be great to read through Peter Rabbit and Jeremy Fisher. And if you do find a mushroom, I bet it's not an LBM or a little brown mushroom, as my colleges call it, but probably potentially something more interesting and taxonomically correct.
Yeah, that's interesting. Seeing that side of the world, that you have that. Is it the standard mushroom number 7 that goes into the illustrations? Yeah, it would be, you know, I'll challenge anybody. If anybody finds a mushroom in a Beatrix Potter and is able to identify it, you know, send a tweet out to me. I'll retweet it for the world to see that that we've got our gumshoes out there. we've got our investigators.
Yeah.
Let's have a
let's have a little mushroom
treasure hunt.
Yes.
So I am continuously impressed with Beatrix's independent exploration and sort of independently discerning what's happening on a mycological scale. So of course the symbiosis of lichen was proposed by a different naturalist, but she was able to kind of take those findings into her own lab and agree with it or find supporting evidence. And then there's the spore germination. And she also kind of supported the idea that there's mycelium underground, and this is where the mushrooms are coming from. And I even read another interesting anecdote in another book, and she had basically determined that, or potentially she determined that Tremella was a mycoparasite. And this is some next level mycology. I mean, even mycologists today are, they got to pour in some research and resources to make these sorts of discoveries. Can you add to this laundry list of things that she's discovered in the mycological world?
Yeah, I mean, I think you make a very good point, which is just how long it took people to verify some of the things that she was working on, like her work with lichen. Some of the aspects on it that she was kind of struggling to establish, scientists were still struggling to establish a century later. That's just how tricky they are, and that she's doing this with a 19th century microscope that she bought with her basically pocket money that she gets from selling the odd card with a holiday. She was like a Hallmark card illustrator for a while to earn some pocket money. Is pretty astonishing. One of the things that I really am impressed with her that I also don't think gets quite enough press is kind of her big scale thinking. So, you know, we get these really tiny things, you know, where she's working with the mycelium, which, you know, had only been really found in any way in 1863, was the first discovery of it. So she does this really small scale stuff, but then she also does this big scale thinking, which anticipates stuff that you see in forest science. So she starts wondering about how is it that, what's the correlation between the types of molds that you see in a forest, the state that they're in, and the types of trees that are around it, right? So she's starting to think about interconnections between different parts of the ecosystem, which is, again, a very different way of thinking than what had been reigning, because up to this point, people are so, you know, after the resistance of being resisting Darwin and Darwinism, by the late 19th century, everybody's on board, and that's all they're interested in doing, is establishing, okay, where did this feature come from? So they are, you know, myopically focused on this individual and their ancestral line of traits. This idea of looking at it from a bigger system perspective of, I'm not as concerned about, you know, where this feature came from evolutionarily. I'm concerned with how this organism, and this organism, which come from totally different parts of the tree of life, how do they mutually support each other, right? Why is it that when I see these trees, this mold looks this way? Thinking on that scale is really, I think, ahead of its time by a good half a century. I think she should get more credit for thinking on that scale, not being so shoved into her microscope that she couldn't step back and think about this ecosystem sort of approach to the natural world.
And like you said, you know, was a driving force why she bought land and put it in conservation, which, you know, like you touched upon, was kind of unheard of. And it wasn't the societal thought at the time that there were superhighways, and, you know, it just wasn't as big of a threat at that time. Now we think more about it, and we see, we have access to internet, the internet, we can see forest fires, we can see oil spills, we can see, you know, super cities popping up. But at that time, you know, to do that was really, she was really ahead of her time in many different ways. And I like what you touched upon of having that bigger ecosystem awareness, that symbiotic awareness is really important. And I think that's a good touchstone for our next question. And I'm going to give a little spin on it for what we usually do. So we ask all of our guests on our show this question. This is a little of an interesting arrangement because you're speaking on behalf of someone. So I'm going to phrase the question like this. If mushrooms had the microphone and could say one thing to the whole human race, what do you think Beatrix Potter would say on behalf of the fungi?
Yeah, that's a great question. And her insight. This is the problem, is that I'm trying to speak for one of the greatest wordsmiths of the English language. So I will state right up front that whatever I say is five orders of magnitude less charming than what Beatrix Potter. I'm just thinking about her like giving a voice to a fungus. And it would be something just so.
It's double ventriloquism like right here.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. It's just sort of I'm inhabiting the body. It's like a body snatcher. So moment. I think she would say something along the lines of do find us as. I don't want to say the word magical, because that's too tawdry for Beatrix Potter, right? It's how she felt, and it's how we feel. But, you know, do find us as otherworldly as we are, right? Give yourself that freedom, because that's the overriding problem that we have become too used to mushrooms. We have allowed ourselves to get too familiar with them in many ways, where we sort of think of them as a supermarket good. And that's sort of where we less, you know, let it lie. But, you know, for organisms that have a cycle of life so different than the bounds of what we are accustomed to and our normal assumptions about what life is and life works, there is a deep strangeness there that is something that will always pay off the deeper that you look at it. So don't let yourself take them in as too worldly, that there is something very otherworldly about how this particular life form has found a way to exist. So she would say it in a way which is so charming I can't even consider it. But do not let us become common would be the closest I could think. Do not let us become common.
I love that. Thanks for sharing your expertise on Beatrix. I was very happy to have found the article you wrote and then was able to contact you through Women You Should Know, which was a whole new journalistic site that I didn't know of until I found that article, and I'm excited to read more.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. I will talk about Beatrix Potter any day of the week. All y'all out there, find yourself Jeremy Fisher. It's my favorite. Get some Jeremy Fisher. Read it tonight. You won't be sorry.
Yeah, I'll have links to the article you wrote, Women You Should Know, a few other things, and then, of course, all of Beatrix's books and where you can read them.
Thanks, y'all, for tuning in, shrooming in to another episode. We love you so much. Please reach out if you have any questions or suggestions for future topics that we should go into or guests that we should bring on our show. head over to our site at mushroomrevival.com. We have a whole lot of blog posts, recipes, more information about mushrooms, whole line of functional mushroom extracts for your health and well-being. And we are sending everyone a big fungal hug and lots of love to you. As always, much love, and may the spores be with you.